On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, Tarek Skubal is already throwing bullpens. Didn't he just have elbow surgery? Yes. We check in on the two-time Cy Young winner, how he's doing on his road back to joining the Tigers rotation. But also, the Tigers are playing some bad baseball. Where are they going to be in the standings when he gets back? We also go around the league, check in on some other important injuries, including Drake Baldwin and Ryan Jeffers. And then I do a little bit of previewing the MLB draft, which is coming up in under 2 months. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that will have what Tarek Skubal's having. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and I would like the nano needle Skubal scope surgery just to see what it feels like.
Hey, if it's this smooth and this relatively uninvasive, why not? I could maybe be back there throwing bullpens before we know it. On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we check back in on Tarek Skubal. We talk about the Detroit Tigers, who are not doing well without him, or with him, I guess, for that matter. check in on some other injuries around the league, some call-ups, some call-downs, and the MLB draft is less than 2 months away. Let's get into it. Tarek Skubal is our opener.
When Tarek Skubal underwent elbow surgery a couple of weeks ago, 12 days ago, 13 days ago at this point, to remove loose bodies in his elbow, we were skeptical when the reporting after the fact was unyieldingly positive. We had concerns. We had doubts. We thought, as the Athletic's Cody Stavenhagen wrote, that it was more of a publicity stunt that Tarek Skubal and agent Scott Boras were talking the big talk and not walking the big walk. Well, yesterday, Tarek Skubal walked one hell of a walk, throwing a bullpen 12 days after surgery. Now, it was not a full gas bullpen. He was not working at 100%. He did throw all of his pitches, which is notable because you often will see guys hold back on breaking balls after surgery for a little bit longer. And now we simply need to reevaluate when Tarek Skubal is going to be back on the field.
Yeah, I think because we are still in uncharted territory with this revolutionary procedure, we cannot put any, you know, circle any dates on the calendar and be like, this is when he's going to be back. There is still going to be a process of building back up. You mentioned the surgery date, his last outing, that last outing in Atlanta, April 29th, right? So there's going to be a process of getting his workload back up. I imagine Tarek Skubal is not going to want to pitch in a major league game if he's only going to go like two innings. I could be wrong about that. Maybe he wants to start that process if he feels like he can do it. You think he will want to come back and throw two innings?
Any bullet that Tarek Skubal has to use, he's going to use it on a major league mound. That would be my guess. I could end up being wrong. I would be surprised if we see him in Toledo or West Michigan.
Oh, sure.
I think if he's throwing at Comerica or wherever the Tigers are playing.
That's fine. I'm not saying a rehab outing. I just, in terms of workload, is it beneficial for the Tigers to activate Tarek Skubal to throw one inning? Now, this is relevant to the larger conversation that we need to have on this episode, which is that the Tigers are very bad right now. And every day that passes without Tarek Skubal, not that even when he was pitching, he was able to impact every game. He is a starting pitcher that can throw once a week, maybe twice a week if the schedule lines up. The Tigers have been essentially the worst team in baseball since Tarek Skubal went down. You can say that is just a coincidence. You can say that it relates to the level of almost mental setback it would take to have Tarek Skubal go down. You can say it relates to the fact that the Tigers roster is maybe not as good as we thought. You can say it relates to the fact that they have other important players that are injured. But the facts are the facts, and the facts are that over their last 30 games, the Tigers are 10-20. Only the Angels have been worse. Over their last 20 games, they're 5-15, tied with the Angels for the worst record in baseball. They have dropped the first two games of the series this week against the Cleveland Guardians at home, continuing a trend that outside of the postseason last year, where the Tigers, I guess, exacted their revenge to some degree after their catastrophic second half collapse by eliminating Cleveland in the postseason. For the most part, over the last few years, Cleveland has had Detroit's number. And we'll get to A.J. Hinch's quote about that dynamic here in a second. But the point is, with or without Skubal, this team has not been nearly as good as we expected, even in an American League that is clearly wide open for the taking. And they are not the only team with high expectations who are struggling to start this season. However, their record is one that reflects a team that is actually not good as opposed to a team that is merely underperforming. So the Skubal part of this is incredible. I think regardless of what happens with the Tigers and where they're at in the standings when he comes back, because he is such an important individual character regardless, I think it's so important and we can talk about that. But remember, so much about it was still him. And you would have to imagine Tarek Skubal's goal to come back was not just because he wants to prove that he's still healthy and awesome and can make all this money, but also because he cares about winning with the Tigers and helping them win. And he might be back. Even if he comes back in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, they're going to be in one heck of a hole. So this is a very strange situation that we are now trying to evaluate.
I do think we need to have the "will Tarek Skubal get traded" conversation at least a little bit now. Do I think Tarek Skubal will get traded? On April 29th, when he got hurt and the Tigers were in first place in the AL Central, I would have put the odds under 5%, right? That he gets traded.
Well, yeah, I mean, at that point,
it's
essentially it's zero. Like
impossible to imagine. Yeah. Right? He gets hurt. They're in first place. You're like, this is not happening. Everything that has happened since that day has pushed that likelihood up. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, of course.
He has come back quicker than anybody could have imagined. He's going to pitch in the big leagues before the trade deadline. And the Tigers have fallen off a cliff, right? And not just in a way that's like, oh, man, that's some bad luck. Like, they're playing bad baseball. And the offense stinks. And injuries on the pitching side, including Skubal, have really hurt them. It is easier to envision a Skubal trade today than it was on the day he got hurt. I'd still say it's not going to happen for a multitude of reasons, but I do think it is worth acknowledging that what has occurred changes the dynamic a little bit.
Yeah, I still think that there are so many unknowns with his return date, with what he looks like when he comes back. That's the other thing. Okay, great. He had this magic surgery and now he's available well sooner than we ever could have expected. Does that mean he suddenly looks like the best version of Tarek Skubal that we saw last year? Which, by the way, we should mention, we were not really seeing before he got injured this season. You know, he was looking pretty good. I would say he did not this season. I mean, sorry, I've said this about Otani, I say this about Judge. When your standard is the best in the world, I will hold you to that standard. He did not look like the best in the world before he went down. He looked like one of the best pitchers in the league, for sure. But let's see, I'm not going to hold him to that standard right when he gets back from this surgery, for sure.
Sure, let's
see how long that takes and what he looks like leading up to the deadline. However, what that conversation is still way more have to do with: where are the Tigers in the standings? If the playoff odds tell Scott Harris that they have a 5% chance of making the postseason come deadline time, and Tarek Skubal is looking awesome, and there are teams calling and saying, here are all of our prospects so that we can have Tarek Skubal for a postseason run, that will be an interesting conversation. But if the Tigers are back at 500 or in third place and their playoff odds are 40%, I just think that there's no chance this is going to be relevant.
Oh, I totally agree. I think if their playoff odds start with two digits, I would be shocked if he gets traded. Now, it is worth mentioning that their playoff odds on Fangraphs have had the largest drop since opening day in the American League. They're number one. They have gone from 59.9 on opening day to 30.3 on May 20th. The only team with a bigger drop since opening day is the
On the AL or in general? The Mets?
In general, the Red New Sox. York Mets. The New York Mets. Yeah. Ding, 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 ding. And it's the New York Mets. But I what I think is relevant, though, about the trade conversation, the injury, you mentioned like, oh, he needs to prove some stuff before a team is going to offer all their prospects for Tarik Skubal, right? I think that the injury is going to make it more difficult to price Tarik Skubal. I think before the injury, it was going to be an expensive proposition for a team that wanted to trade for him. But I think that they would understand the dynamic. Like, you're paying for the best thing and you're getting the best thing, and that costs a lot. Now you're not getting something as dependable, no matter really how he looks. Like, even if he comes back and he's like immediately incredible, it changes that a little bit, right? And in the event that he comes mm-hmm. back and he looks just excellent like he did to start the season, I think it'll make it more difficult for Tigers president of baseball operations Scott Harris and another team to kind of find a middle ground on like what that version of Tarik Skubal is worth on the trade market.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. That said, let's put the trade conversation to the side, because
sure,
there is still time for the Tigers to dig their way out of it. However, there is a lot going wrong right now. Well, it is not just that Skubal is not on the team. There are players that are still missing, and a lot of the players that they were counting on, some of whom are new, some of whom are not, have not been nearly good enough. And that is why they find themselves tied with the Royals for last place in the American League Central. So should we survey what has gone wrong for Detroit?
Yeah, they don't hit. They don't hit. In May, they're last in slugging percentage, 28th in OPS. Besides Riley Green, who is going to be their only all-star.
Yeah, all right. That's what would be my expectation right now. I mean, maybe Casey Mize, but yeah.
Their only all-star. This offense has been terrible. Vierling and Dingler have been fine in May. McGonagall has kind of fallen off a cliff a little bit. Torkelson has been bad. Colt Keith has been bad. Wenzel Perez has been bad. Zach McKinstry, who was an all-star last year, I believe has an OPS that starts with a 3 in the month of May. Yep. Mm-hmm. It's not great. This is a fun little nugget. Riley Green's batting average is higher than Kerry Carpenter and Zach McKinstry's OPS in the month of May.
Oh, all right. So what I see here is a roster, and yes, again, there are some guys missing, and Glaber was playing pretty well before he went down, and it seems like he should be back reasonably soon. And Glaber is such an important part of this team. I know we weren't even necessarily expecting him to be back. You know, he accepts the qualifying sure. offer to return, but he's the kind of hitter that is his floor. It's just so much higher than a lot of these other guys.
Absolutely.
And that was so comforting to kind of have at the top of the lineup. And so when that's missing, sure. you can see the problems there. Yeah.
In the league, needs a player that when you say, what does that guy do here? The answer is, oh, he hits. Mm-hmm. And there's no like question. There's no what kind of hit does he hit? Like, no. Oh, Glaber? Yeah, Glaber hits. Like, Glaber hits. He has always hit. He will always hit. Like, now the ceiling is maybe not there. Like, he's not going to win an MVP award. But he offers a level of reliability in the middle of the lineup that any team can get. I would like to compare the Tigers to the Yankees for a quick second.
Oh,
because these okay. two teams.
Sure.
Yeah. 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 One has 27 rings. One has fewer. But both of these teams took a similar tact over the winter, at least with their offenses, right? Where they were like, hey, we're running it back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're not making outside external additions. We're not signing big free agents. We're not making big trades. We like our mix. We're running it back. Gleyber Torres, Trent Grisham both come back on the qualifying offer. The big difference, obviously, is that the Tigers are able to call up Kevin McGonagall. But for the most part, they're like, we like our group. We made the playoffs. We're running it back. The difference is the Yankees won 96 games, and the Tigers spent the second half of 2025 falling down the standings and playing bad baseball. And so I'm not exactly like shocked that we're sitting here on May 20th and saying, oh, this group of Tigers players is underperforming. Because at no point, like, Riley Green turning into this level of player is very encouraging and a big deal. But the question, how do they keep doing this? For whatever reason, this group was like, well, I don't know how long it can keep it going. And now we're seeing some of these bananas turning brown, some of these guys turning into pumpkins a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, pumpkins, or how good were they to begin with? I think in some cases, what's really frustrating is that the Tigers over the past few years, they've gotten a lot of credit for all these pieces kind of fitting together, whether it's these platoons, whether it's versatile players that can bounce around to multiple positions. The problem is the guys that they've committed to and really believe in are really not performing. Now, Cary Carpenter being injured is not great, and he was at least slugging before he got hurt. But you mentioned McKinstry. Jamai Jones, who had been so productive for them in that very specific role, has been terrible. Wenzel Perez, who I was really kind of buying into as an average player, has been atrocious. Colt Keith, who they gave an extension to, you know, very early on in his career, there's parts of his game that are impressive. He's hitting near 300. Dude's got zero homers. And at some point, if you're going to be hitting in the middle of the lineup, he's bounced back. I mean, he looked so bad at the end of last season that I was really worried. But he's not really giving you anything, and especially defensively. And then Torque is his own conversation, difficult thing because of everything that comes along with Torque.
I would now like to compare the Tigers to the Red Sox. Just the Yankees will do the Red Sox now. The Red Sox entered 2026 with the offensive plan to revolving around Roman Anthony, right? Which was reasonable to an extent because, wow, what a talent. But was unreasonable to an extent because that's a child and you can't depend on children always. That is sort of what the Tigers have done here with Kevin McGonigal. Now, did they think McGonigal was going to be up on opening day necessarily? He had a great spring. I understand it's a little bit of a different dynamic, obviously, right? But lot on McGonigal's shoulders, right? Like, we were having conversations like, is he the best player on the Tigers already? We were probably a little bit over our skis on that. And now you're looking at the team and you're like, okay, so what's gone worse than you expected? Well, Kevin McGonigal has been bad for 3 weeks, you know? And I think that is an unfair amount of pressure to put on a guy. Go ahead.
I agree with your larger point, but Kevin McGonigal kind of cooling off is very low on the list of my concerns for this team whatsoever. How good he was to start, he banked more positive production than negative production so far. Sure, it has not helped during this recent skid. Kevin McGonigal, both moving forward, even for the last few weeks, yes, he has certainly hit a bit of a cool stretch. He's very far down my list of worries, and I still consider him one of the guys I am still counting on moving forward. Oh. But your point about the team putting it all in on him, I'm totally with
you. I'm not worried about him or blaming him, and I think the same is true with how I feel about Roman Anthony and the Red Sox. It's more just like, when you construct a roster this way, this is what can happen to you if you go about it in that manner. So, like, okay, so then how do things turn around? Let's paint a rosy picture here for the Tigers for a second. Well, go ahead.
Here's the problem. We can focus on the offense and how they didn't address it and how they leaning too much on McGonigal and they didn't change enough and some of these players aren't actually that good. That is all correct. That is all none of that. I stand by all of that. However, when we did our run prevention draft, I believe you took the Detroit Tigers first. Okay. Oops. And the reason for that is they had Tarek Skubal. They signed Framber Valdez. They had a bullpen that we believed AJ Hinch knew how to manage. They brought back Finnegan and signed Kenley Jansen. And we liked some of their younger arms and my step forward. And even if we've always been the lowest on Jack Flaherty, and that has continued to be a very, very, very bad spot in the rotation, there was still a lot on the mound here that we were feeling really good at. Will Vest, who now is a 6 ERA. That is what has truly fallen apart. Justin Verlander, there's a name we should probably mention. Not that we were counting too much on him, because he's the oldest pitcher in the league. But that is where they have fallen so far behind what the hype was going into the season. Some due to injury, some due to underperformance. And I bring that up because in theory, that is what they can get back to being their identity. If Fromber can start pitching better, if Scooble's back in a few weeks, if the bullpen can kind of get back on, you know, on its feet, I guess, but I don't know where they're going to be in the standings. And a lot of these pitchers have not shown me enough to make me think that's going to happen. I love the Fromber signing. I love Fromber Valdez. I know he's embarrassed himself on multiple occasions last season, this season, whatever.
You love me, and I've embarrassed myself on multiple occasions.
That's true. That's true. But I'm way more, it's much more easier for me to look at Fromber Valdez. It's me just be like, well, that's a problem, okay. But it's not my problem. In your case, it's like, well, this is going to impact me. For Fromber Valdez, though, if you're a Tigers fan, this is a tough, this is when you need, we talked about it right when the Scooble injury happened and with the stupid Valdez getting suspended, but this is still relevant. Even now that he's back, that guy needs to be going out there and giving you quality starts, and it's not happening.
He's one of the highest paid pitchers in the game, dude. And he's not moving like it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I know this is my response to you being asking me how are they going to turn this around. And that's why I'm saying I'm not really sure, because what are they good at? What is the path?
What were they good at before was all the mixing and matching and AJ Hinchification of the roster. But AJ Hinch is only as good as the roster. Like, you can bring in the lefty, but if the lefty gives up a bomb to a lefty, then, like, that's not an AJ Hint, right? Like, we see this all the time. How much is on the manager's shoulders? How much is on the roster itself? And I think right now it's mostly on the roster. I think the path back is Scooble's great. When he returns, he looks like Tarik Skubal. A lot of the pitchers kind of return closer to their career norms. They get healthier. McGonagall heats up again. And, like, I don't think this team is this bad. I don't think they're, like, a last-place team. But it really has been ugly. Just one more thing on Scooble that is just a – did you see the size of the incision?
No, I have not. I've not seen that.
So you can kind of see it in the press conference he's doing. Like, he has his arms folded. It's, like, the size of a pea. It's unbelievable.
Nano
needle. Like, I really cannot emphasize enough how transformative this surgery could be for our sport. Because it's not just guys that are getting surgery for this and missing time. It is guys throwing through this. Because when you have loose bodies, there is discomfort. And you don't want to go under the knife, because then you're going to miss the whole season or miss a large portion of the season. If Tarik Skubal comes back in a month, I think you will see so many guys taking advantage of this. If you like, I believe that whenever you see a player with a really strong track record be awful for more than 3 weeks, they're playing through something. Like, I think that's true 70% of the time, or they're getting old. And so, like, for pitchers, I guarantee you, there are notable names over the last half decade that have had bad stretches, and it's because they have, like, bone chips in their arm. And now those guys are just going to get the surgery. And this is a positive development in the injury issue epidemic that we're having in our game right now with pitchers. So I think it is worth emphasizing the positives. From emphasizing the positives to emphasizing the negatives. So things have really gone bad for the Tigers. And so we're going to break back out a segment that we have not done in a while. It is Sorry for Your Mentions. Jordan, explain the bit.
So I don't believe we've done this yet this season, but one of our favorite things on the modern baseball internet experience, as awful as it often is to be online, something that often makes us laugh, is to go to the final score posts from the official team accounts amid particularly brutal stretches for teams, when it is the admin's job to post the final score to inform their followers the result of the game. Unfortunately for the Tigers fans following at Tigers right now, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear from the team, even if they're just reporting
Save it.
That the Tigers that the Tigers lost again. And so what we do is we go into the mentions of these official team accounts and we offer an apology to those whose job it was to post it, because these mentions are not particularly friendly or welcoming or forgiving or patient. And so even though these tweets are not actually being directed at the people that have lost the baseball game, we are going to read them anyway because they are often very funny.
Who knows? Maybe President of Baseball Operations Scott Harris and AJ Hinch are reading along through these for feedback and taking them into account moving forward. Probably not, but maybe. Detroit Tigers tweeted last night at 9:07 p.m. Guardians 4, Tigers 3. A lot of these comments are basketball related after the Detroit Pistons season ended also at the hands of a Cleveland outfit. But we're going to run through some that are not related to hoops. Walter says, Cleveland bunted twice tonight that directly resulted in two runs right after the sacrifice. WTF does AJ do to manufacture runs? Absolutely nothing. With a putrid offense, he should be bunting. Just sits there waiting for the HR that never comes. Thoughts, Jordan? More bunts?
Begging for more bunts is about as bleak as it gets. But the Guardians make you think some weird things, folks.
Peach says, this is some of the most uninspiring baseball we've ever seen. Tigers fan 63 replies to that. The Tigers have become the tapioca pudding of Major League Baseball.
Tell me about the tapioca pudding comparison. That one threw me
goopy,
off.
Goopy? Unsavory? I'm not particularly sure. This next one is from Larry. They look lost, demoralized, confused, clueless, drained, etc.
The etc. is killing me here. This is like you pulled up like the thesaurus, right? And you were dropping
thesaurus.
You're just dropping synonyms,
tweet.
But then you were like, etc. You know, other words of the like. Oh, yeah. So funny.
Holly responded to Larry and just wrote, for some time now.
True.
Dwayne says, you should maybe DFI about four of those boys and bring up the kids they couldn't do any worse. Designate for internment? Designate for incineration?
I and A, nowhere near each other on the keyboard.
Very far.
So I don't know how this person thought that it was DFI, but
knowing, maybe he's Australian and he's like, DFI. I got a DFI. Oh. He's listening to Ryan Roland Smith talk about DFA. And, and it's also funny because knowing that it's called a DFA and not just saying release this player shows a level of like baseball knowledge.
Demote, down. Yeah.
Cut. Whatever. Yeah, but like DFI is so close to DFI, but maybe DFI. He's like, they should deify them. Like, you know.
Ooh, that's dramatic.
Okay. DFI these players. Next one from Ben. Ben says, LOL people, it's not even June yet. We still got a lot of season left. This tweet has no likes. So Ben, thanks for trying to be positive in the mentions, but not going to stick. Someone with the username 72 says, how do Scott Harris have a job? How do Scott Harris have a job?
Well, that's a good question. How do he?
Because Scott Harris have contract and Scott Harris go to playoffs 2 years in a row. That would be why Scott
Harris
have a
job. That's how he have a job.
Jake, not me. Jake says, was there booing at least?
So this is great, right? Because whether Jake watched the game or not, like he could find out, he could ask any other fan that was there, find someone and be like, hey, could just make sure they were booing, right? Booing. I hope they were at least booing.
At least. You know who's not telling you? At Tigers.
You asked the wrong account. You could definitely source this information, just not from at Tigers.
Holly, back again here. Holly, who said for some time now to the thesaurus tweet, Holly here says, boo! Thank you, Holly. Couple more. Celeberry says, the boys may not win another game this year, but I'll be watching.
We should just finish on this one. I mean, this is baseball fandom, folks. This is what it's all about. Is you just say, or, you know, like the FU, see you tomorrow. Like, that is what this is. It's just beautiful. I've never seen this described so beautifully. You can't quit them. You can't. You have to watch again tomorrow. You have to. Sorry. We're sickos. Oh, my God. So good.
At Tigers.
Sorry to At Tigers.
Our apologies.
Yeah.
Sorry for your mentions. Yeah. And sorry to Tigers fans. Keep tweeting, though. This was a strong batch. Strong batch of mentions.
Yes. We're going to take a break. I will mention, though, Cleveland Guardians on the other end of this, they're playing some good ball, and they probably will deserve a longer conversation here at some point. But for now, we will focus on D'Trois. All right. We are going to take a break. When we return, some other injury updates. No more nano needles, although I guess Blake Snell, but we're not going to talk about him. Gerrit Cole's coming back. Drake Baldwin is hurt. Royce Lewis is in the minors. And we'll talk about Dylan Cruz. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Do you like news? Not the important world is burning kind, the fun baseball kind. Let's go around the league. You get a boo-boo. You get an ouchie. Everyone gets an injury. Not good, friends. Shining ray of light. Gerrit Cole will be back on Friday off the IL after missing a long stretch. We'll talk about that on Friday. We know it happened. We are staying abreast. Okay. We're well read. Our news literacy is high. But for right now, we're going to focus on the negative. Drake Baldwin, one of the best players in the sport, is going on the IL with an oblique strain, putting the bleak in oblique. Now, the reason that this is particularly relevant is that the other Braves catcher, Sean Murphy, is also hurt. And so the Atlanta Braves, the best team in the sport, is going to be rolling with the Sandy Leone Chadwick Tromp tandem behind the dish for a while.
And catching's pretty important, folks. And when your catchers are normally this good and then suddenly Sandy Leone and Chadwick Tromp, that is something to be taken seriously as we evaluate the Atlanta Braves. I will say that beyond, you know, we had a little run of hamate injuries, and we've got another one here we'll talk about with Ryan Jeffers. We've been talking about loose bodies and pitchers' elbows. Boy, have we been, I feel like oblique strains have just been all over the place this season. I mean, this has been a popular one as well.
A theory.
All right, let's hear it.
I think obliques are the hitter's elbows. Here's what I mean by this. Pitching development over the last 10 years, half decade, whatever, we've seen so many more pitcher injuries because guys are trying to throw as hard as possible and pushing themselves to the limit of their rotational abilities, right? For hitters, that has happened slightly after, like that's on a bit of a tape delay, but we see it with bat speed training. Now, I don't know if Drake Baldwin in particular is swinging harder or did bat speed training or whatever, but that would be the muscle where you would have issues with trying to rip your body across itself at a faster pace than you had before. What do you think about this half-baked idea that just popped into my head?
I think it sounds pretty good to me as far as Jake Mintz's medical analysis goes. I think this is near the top of the pile. I think it's pretty well
Dr.
done.
But Mintz,
It's not just, right, Baldwin, Jose Altuve now out with an oblique strain. That is why Cal Raleigh is on the IL. Gino Suarez, Gleyber Torres, who we just mentioned earlier. Dylan Beavers with Baltimore. So there's a bunch of guys. But as for how this impacts Atlanta, yeah, I think Sean Murphy was weird. He had missed most of the start of the year, came back, and then I think he immediately took, was it a foul tip or a bat off the hand?
Bat.
The point is he played like two games after he got back, or very a small number, and then was immediately back on the IL. That sucks because Sean Murphy, even as he has sort of declined more recently, you know, that felt like a potential superpower for Atlanta, that they also still had Sean Murphy in the event that Drake Baldwin needed a rest or whatever. But now they're going to be leaning on Sandy Leon, who, God, how old is Sandy Leon now? I mean, it feels like he's been around for, 37. Okay, so he just turned 37 in March. Yeah, this is his 14th season. He played this kind of sums up where Sandy Leon has been with the Braves last year. He played five games for them last season, and he has already played five games for them this season and is going to play a lot more moving forward. So
with love and affection, no player in baseball right now looks more like a men's league Sunday afternoon difference maker than Sandy Leon.
Or just the coach. Or just the coach. I think, but even regardless of focusing too much on Leon and Trump and however they replace him, while that is important, it's the first thing you said. It's that Drake Baldwin has been if the season ended right now, would be a top 5 to 7 MVP finisher, arguably even ahead of Matt Olson. He has been truly spectacular. The defense has improved. He's been a ridiculous hitter. And as we mentioned, what he showed last year as a rookie, wins rookie of the year, shouldn't be that surprised. But man, has he been a difference maker. Now I will say that the focus for Atlanta shifts back to Acuña, who they just got back from the injured list, which is nice. He had yet to really heat up before he went down.
Ronald.
And we're going to need Ron to start cooking here, because as we've mentioned about the Braves offense, Olson and Baldwin have been unbelievable. Ozzie's enjoyed a nice bounce back. Harris has been good. Riley's sort of starting to find it, but now should be when, especially because we had Baldwin that had been elevated to the leadoff spot. We need Ronald to start setting the tone again atop the lineup and keep the Braves where they are. I think it's going to be really important.
Just a quick couple Twins things. Don't stop listening. Don't stop listening. It's the Twins, but please keep listening. Please, please, please. Ryan Jeffers, their catcher, fractured hamate. This is relevant because there was a chance he was going to be and still could be the best hitter dealt at the deadline. I know that sounds wild. It is a very weak free agent class of hitters. Most of the ones at the top of the market, Jazz Chisholm, Seiya Suzuki, are on competitive teams, Ian Happ. So you're not going to see those guys get traded. We don't often see catchers get dealt at the deadline, but Jeffers is kind of an exception because he is a hitter that happens to catch, right? Mm-hmm. He has a 164 OPS plus, 7 home runs. He's hitting 295. This guy rakes. He has raked for a while. You could envision a team adding him and having him be like the main DH and then working him through once or twice a week behind the plate. Now that he's hurt with a hamate thing, that'll change that a little bit. Twins also sending Royce Lewis down. Former number one overall pick, has struggled mightily this season. A sign that the Twins are kind of caught in this weird no man's land of trying to win now and trying to win, like playing for the long haul. They are a top five lost in the wilderness franchise. And Royce Lewis going down to AAA is a big sign of that. Any thoughts on the Twins? Actually, you know what? No. You're not allowed thoughts on the Twins. Let's keep moving along. The Washington Nationals. Oh, you're going to roll your eyes at me? Sorry. Go ahead. You talk about the Twins. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I just, you know, the Royce Lewis up and down is really one of the stranger and sadder developmental stories we've had in quite some time. And this will relate to our next topic, which is Dylan Cruz. But, I mean, Dan Hayes of The Athletic has really covered it well. It's just Royce Lewis, for so long, it was like, can he stay on the field? And if he is, he's going to be great. He's just been bad now for almost two seasons. And I know people that aren't following the Twins don't realize that, but that's how you end up here. And it sucks. And Royce Lewis has been very open about realizing that the Twins might be kind of shuffling him out the door because they have better players coming up behind him. But I hope that he can kind of get back on track, because when he's cooking, it's good. The point is, he's just been bad for a long time now, and that's why you get to this point. It is not, this has not just been a thing of, oh, he's hurt. No. He's been bad. And it sucks, because, yeah, number one overall picks are important.
Upside. Doesn't have to move. Triple A team in the same city. Ha ha.
Love that.
Silver linings, baby. Love
that. I'm sure he's thrilled.
From someone who didn't have to move to someone who's ecstatic to be moving, and that is Dylan Cruz. Dylan Cruz, back in the bigs with the Washington Nationals, recalled yesterday. I love the phrase recall, because it sounds like the team is going, oh yeah, I remember him. I recall Dylan Cruz. Sure, yeah, let's bring him back. There are a million things to talk about with Dylan Cruz. He is, for me, like a top 15 guy that fascinates me in the sport, just like as a character. I'll do the short version. I'll speed run it. I was there last night, so I could talk a little bit about the environment. Dylan Cruz is like the best 15-year-old baseball player in the world when he's 15. He commits to LSU as a freshman. He's on the circuit. He is as known of a commodity at the amateur level as there really can be, non-Bryce Harper division. He's basically hitting the whole time, decides to go to LSU in part because he wants the experience. Now, yes, there were some concerns about the size. Is he going to, you know, have enough power at the big league level? He wouldn't have got the money he wanted, sure. But he really wanted to go be at LSU, goes to Baton Rouge, obliterates the competition, sets the SEC and college baseball ablaze. 2023, who wins the Golden Spikes Award? Not Paul Skeens, Dylan Cruz, because he hit over 400 and was incredible. Nats take him second overall behind Skeens in that draft. There are a lot of teams that on their boards have Cruz over Skeens. To be clear, I don't think the Nationals were one of those teams. They end up with Cruz and are quite happy to have him. He rockets through the minor leagues despite not putting up great surface level numbers, but the underlying stuff was fine. Scouts loved him. Analysts appreciated the pedigree. He debuts in 2024 and is just like not that good. 2025 starts the year in the outfield on opening day. Not that good. Gets hurt. I think it was his oblique. Shouts out obliques. Comes back. Still not good. Entering this camp, it was a make or break kind of year for him. Shows up to spring training and is just like lost ass. Like not, no approach. Swinging at everything. A man without a plan. So the Nats option him to AAA. Rochester. And that is kind of where our story begins in earnest, because Dylan Cruz, this man, and this is why this fascinates me, this man with sky high expectations for himself, a person who, since they were 14, 15, knew that they would be a big leaguer one day, for whom just being a big leaguer is not enough, is standing there in Rochester, New York on opening day in 40 degree weather, wearing a balaclava, the coldest he's ever been in his life. 2 days later, he's wearing an alternate uniform that says garbage plates on it. And like, meanwhile, the Nats are having a great time scoring a whole boatload of runs. And here's Dylan Cruz, the guy who's supposed to be the future of this franchise, forced to reckon with his own flaws. Right. And I asked Paul Toboni, their president of baseball operations, about this yesterday. Like, when you're a great player and you've been a great player for a long time, and that is what Dylan Cruz is and was, when do you know to change your process? And when do you know to just be stubborn and push through and trust it, right? That is like such a difficult balance. And it seems like that took Cruz some time, understandably so, because he had always been great and assumed that what he was doing was working. The Nationals were able in AAA to kind of convince him to make some changes with his approach, be more aggressive at pitches he could drive, chase less, get the ball in the air more. That started showing up in the underlying stuff over the last couple of weeks. Here we are, Dylan Cruz, back in the big leagues.
Yeah, and I am still, I mean, listen, I was one of the guys that would have taken Cruz over Skeens because I'm a coward and pitchers are scary. But
you're a big
what we've seen with him in pro ball, yeah, hey, thanks. What we've seen from him in pro ball, and even still this year, is someone that is still hitting the ball really hard. You know, just looking at his AAA numbers this season, and I know that some of them have gotten even better over the last week. You know, average exit velocity is like 98th percentile, but he's not hitting the ball in the air that much. He's still whiffing more than you would expect. And that was some of the concern with his swing, even at LSU. He was hitting the ball so hard all the time. He did have more slugging numbers, but again, the pitching is just much worse. His slugging ability has generally been neutralized in pro ball, even if he's still hitting the ball hard. And so that is the part that they're still going to have to find a way for him to access at the major league level. Now, he can be a good hitter without hitting 30 homers, because I think that there is a good approach in there that can become, even though we haven't seen it statistically yet, I think that that can be kind of unlocked. And then the other thing about him, now the bat is the most important thing for obvious reasons. That said, I'm also still fascinated by his defensive outlook. This is something I asked Butera about at the winter meetings, I believe, is just like, where do you envision Dylan Cruz in the outfield? And part of that is because of this group of Nationals outfielders that they have collected, which has been a really compelling group, right? We know, of course, James Wood. Of course, Jacob Young in center field defensively has been a star. Dalen Lyles had an interesting start to his career, but defensively has been pretty inconsistent. Dylan Cruz in the minors, it looks like he's basically been alternating between center, left, and right almost every other day. I would expect that will continue to sort of be the case. Like, how much center field run do you expect him to get in the big leagues? That would be my last question for you here.
It'll be Dalen and Wood will be like the DHs. And then there will be days where like someone else DHs and Jacob Young doesn't play, or Cruz, like it'll be a rotation. I expect him to play center field like 2 or 3 days a week. That's okay. Just like a loose guess at it. And the thing with Cruz is like, I'm going to be the last guy off the bandwagon. I will be the last guy. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is, he does the most important thing, and that's hit the ball hard. And to hit the ball hard, he doesn't really like, he's not like swinging out of his ass all the time. You know what I mean? Like it's a shorter swing, and he hits the crap out of it. And fixing the launch angle, in my opinion, is something that is more doable over the long haul. Like we've seen guys that hit the ball hard on the ground have relatives like Yandy Diaz, right? Has made a nice living never getting the ball in the air and hitting the crap out of it. And I'm not saying that's what Dylan Cruz is going to be or whatever. It's just, it gives me some comfort about him moving forward. And just the pedigree is nuts. It's nuts. We are biased because we watched this guy have one of the greatest college baseball seasons of all time. And that is my bias. Like, I was talking to Mark Zuckerman, who covers the Nats, and he was like, he said to me, like, I've never seen Dylan Cruz be great in person. Right. And like for us, it's the opposite, where we frankly weren't watching a whole lot of Dylan Cruz at bats over the last couple of years because, you know, the Nats weren't giving us reasons to. And so I think it is important to acknowledge both of those biases of like where we're coming from, but they're real. Right. And for that reason, like, it's difficult to look at it objectively. I'm excited. I think he's a pro. He handled it well. He's awesome to talk to. He gave a really interesting detail yesterday that like his fiance cried upon finding out that he was going back up. Like this is meaningful. This is real stuff for him. Like the fact that he had to go down to AAA was humble pie. It was a rude awakening. And I'm fascinated to see where this goes. Because, Jordan, for every Bryce Harper, there are 5 Jared Kelenics. Just because you have a high opinion of yourself, just because you think you're destined for big league greatness at a young age, does not necessarily mean you're going to achieve it.
Well, and also, just goes back to Royce Lewis. You know, Royce Lewis seemed to be firmly on track to living up to the hype, but baseball's not just going to wait around and let you be. So, like, you are going to have to continue to make those adjustments. Dylan Cruz has yet to even have that success at the major league level, but I'm glad that he's going to get the opportunity to show what I think we and a lot of other people think that he is capable of. We are going to take a break. When we return, we will keep keep talking about some high draft picks because the MLB draft is coming up at the All-Star break, and I wrote about it this week, so we're going to talk about it. We'll be right back on Baseball Barbershop.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Oftentimes on this show, when I ask Jordan a question or he asks me a question, the other person knows the answer. It is merely podcast fodder. Jordan, what did the Tigers do last night? I know what the Tigers did last night. I'm just being a responsible podcast host, right? We are not interviewing one another here. There's a document that we go off of. We know what's coming. That is not the case with this next segment, because Jordan is going to hold my hand and guide me through this upcoming MLB draft. Why are you shaking your head, Jordan?
Well, because I think that I still think that the way that we can have this conversation, and we'll have more draft conversations leading up to, you know, we're still 2 months out or so. So no need to dump it all here. But I know that you have not been following it as closely. I know that this year you have not followed the Division I season as closely as you normally do, which is understandable. But I wrote this week at Yahoo through the lens of the big questions that I have about this year's draft, this year's class, the players in it, the strengths and weaknesses, certain teams that have my attention. But I still think that you are plenty equipped to ask some of these questions as well. So, you know, you can read my story today and go through it. We're not going to go through all of them, but I want to allow you to also ask some of these questions if there are things that, from what you have seen, you are wondering about, or we can kind of go through the questions that I'm thinking about, because I know you are going to have the answers to these questions, but yeah.
This is the least I've paid attention to college sports since I graduated college. There are a variety of reasons for that, and it bums me out. And every time I want to get back into it, I feel intimidated by how much I've missed. And now I'm going on vacation for 2 weeks out of the country. And so, like, I'm not going to – it's the right time to hop back in. I probably won't. And so it bums me out. However, that makes me a reliable character in this conversation, because George Schusterman, Rock Chalowski, is a name I know. I watched him in Omaha last year. He has been the projected number one pick for 2 years now for the upcoming draft. Is he going to go first to the Chicago White Sox?
Yeah, I think Rock is the name that has kind of broken through as a main character, even for those who don't necessarily follow college baseball that closely. When he got to UCLA originally, it was exciting, but even his freshman year, particularly because UCLA had a rare, terrible season his freshman year, it was like, okay, well, this is cool. They're building something. And UCLA has been unique in this regard because they haven't leaned as heavily on the transfer portal the way so many other modern teams do. They had this incredible class that showed up as freshmen 3 years ago, Rock, the headliner, and they sucked. But what they did last year to go from sucking as freshmen to just being superstars as sophomores, with Rock leading the way, getting to Omaha, that really changed the tone of just not only their program, but also Rock, because that made him just this, especially with the name, with the Bruins, you know, brand, with getting them to Omaha, kind of a really easy character to latch onto and be like, this is the next great draft prospect. And the fact that he is now within 2 months away from holding on to that distinction the entire draft cycle is incredible and very rare, and something that should not go overlooked. And yet, I still bring up this question here when I write about it this week, because it is not set in stone. There is still a lot that can change. And the two main things that I think I want people to think about when it comes to Rock, one is, what does Rock still have to prove? Because the Bruins and Rock dominated the Big Ten this season. And yes, UCLA is in the Big Ten now. It's very funny. To a predictably hilarious degree. They went 28-2 in conference play. They didn't lose a series. They've been ranked number one the whole year. The other reason I'm doing this now is because the college baseball postseason is about to start. Conference tournament's going on this week. Then we'll have regionals. UCLA will either be the number one or number two overall seed. And how they do, I'm curious if what Rock does in the postseason makes a difference, because there have been some discussions about, okay, well, he hasn't done it against the SEC competition or ACC competition, and there's still some signs, well, all right, well, how is this hit tool going to play? If the Bruins and Rock do not get to Omaha, or they flame out in a bit, does that be like, oh, wait a minute, maybe he's not so infallible?
But how much of that is prospect fatigue?
Well, right, right. Because that's the thing. He has successfully fended it off because he's had another great season in a way that I'm even impressed by. I thought it might have happened earlier, but because they keep on winning and he's continued to be great, it's been like, well, what are you going to say? He hasn't disappointed. But now that the stakes are where the whole season, it's been like, okay, UCLA, we'll see you in the postseason. Let's see if they can kind of land the plane, as they say, both as a team. Not that the expectation is national championship or bust, although I do think that some people are viewing it that way. But for him to also get to the first pick, which brings up the other main thing with Rock, which is that there is another player that a lot of smart people that follow the draft and who are scouts and evaluators said, well, this guy might actually be better. And that is high school shortstop Grady Emerson from Fort Worth Christian in Texas. And kind of in the same way that Rock was and Dylan Cruz was, Grady Emerson has been considered the best player in his class since he was 14 or 15. He has held that distinction all the way through the spring. He's continued to look great. And while it is essentially impossible for a high school prospect to be a main character, even with all the Instagram reels and the more attention that we have on social media to amateur baseball, Grady Emerson has not necessarily embraced that in the same way that, say, like a Max Clark has. And so he's just going about his business. But there are scouts that go see Grady Emerson and say, he's the better player. He's the younger player. He's the one that we think has the higher ceiling. Should the White Sox just take Grady Emerson? But because the expectation is that Rock is going to go first no matter what, it does create a really interesting dynamic. So if you ask me today, I still think it's Rock, but we'll see how it goes.
I also think it's worth thinking about it through the lens of like what types of players have the White Sox taken or prioritized and tried to acquire through trade. Like particularly with the Crochet deal is in some ways really revealing that they went for these more, you know, higher floor college type guys like Brandon Montgomery and Kyle Teal, and they weren't shooting the moon with lower level Latin prospects or high school toolsy dudes, right? And so I just, again, this is feel and you know better than me, like just feels like Chris Getz is gonna, their GM who played in the big leagues, like it feels like more of a Rock Chalowski oriented guy.
I agree on that. I do think the last thing I'll say about this, and then we can move on to one or two other questions before we get out of here. You never draft for need. You should draft the best player. You draft the player you believe in. However, it's hard not to look at the White Sox right now and think about Rock Chalowski as a prospect, even in the most glowing version of it, which is a damn good shortstop who should be a pretty damn good hitter. You know, this is Dansby Swanson has been the comp. I think there's maybe more offensive upside with Rock, but also definitely a shortstop. And if you think that Rock Chalowski is the kind of player, as we've seen with a lot of the other top college players in recent years, all right, great. Well, we'll see you in the big leagues in a year, right? The White Sox left side of the infield right now is looking pretty good. I mean, Colson Montgomery, most importantly, looks like a shortstop. He is playing incredible defense.
Awesome defensively.
And is like that. That is an amazing development. And then my goodness, what Miguel Vargas has been doing at third. So should that influence how they handle this draft? No, but this is the rare case where it's kind of hard not to think about it.
Yeah, I think it should now that you bring that up, because if Chalowski gets to the same level of production that Colson Montgomery has gotten to, everyone's stoked. Like, that's a win, right?
Sure.
With the first pick?
Yeah.
Where he's playing, like, elite defense, and he's at a, what is he, like a 128 OPS plus hitter right now? Like,
oh, Montgomery?
We get that. Like, if we get that from Chalowski, it's huge. 130. Like, that's really interesting, because the selling point of Chalowski is he'll be up there soon. And the ideal future for the Chicago White Sox is that Colson Montgomery is their shortstop for a long time. Now, a million different things could happen, and you should probably just take the better player. But if you were to design a dynamic where you would draft for need or wouldn't draft because of your big league roster, it would look a whole lot like this.
Yeah, and yet you could say, well, Grady Emerson's a shortstop, and if he's so special, he's probably going to be up in the next 2 or 3 years too, and what does that mean for him? So it's a weird dynamic, and honestly, I think that's a good reason to bring in just the other top players in the class, I think is maybe the one other topic I want to hit.
Sure, just one quick thing on there. I think it's worth just briefly talking about the difference in athleticism between Chalowski and Emerson. where like
sure.
Rock, you're not moving Rock Chulaski to center field. Like that guy's playing on the dirt, right? Right? I think correct. Emerson, correct. You could envision because of the way he moves. Now, again, more value at short. I get it. You can envision moving him to and being a valuable defensive center fielder, right? Because like he can move and
whatever. Yeah, or right field, Chulaski, whatever. It's
or right field, easier whatever. To Chulaski's sure. on the dirt. The value of Rock Chulaski yes. is that he's going to be a plus shortstop. So I think that's just worth yes. distinguishing. Back
yeah.
to you.
Yeah, yeah. And so you could say, okay, well, he could be an awesome second baseman, and maybe that's where he fits, and whatever. But it is a rare dynamic there. So we'll see if that influences. Now, that said, the expectation still right now is that the White Sox are choosing between those two players. However, I saw one heck of a ball player last weekend when I was in Boston and saw Georgia Tech play against Boston College and just absolutely demolish them. If you are wondering who is the kind of team that could maybe give UCLA a challenge in the postseason, and there's plenty of SEC teams as well, Georgia, Auburn, Texas. But Georgia Tech is having one heck of a season. They are very reminiscent of the Tennessee team we saw 2 years ago that had, I believe, five hitters drafted in the first five rounds. That is what we are going to see with Georgia Tech this year. The pitching is a little bit more suspect, but they've got enough of it, and I still think we're top two in the SEC, in the ACC in ERA, and they won the conference crown again, 25-5 in conference, which is ridiculous in the ACC. But the player I'm referencing is Vaughn Lackey, who is their catcher. A lot of attention has been paid to Drew Burris, who is their center fielder, who's had one of the most incredible college careers that we've seen in the 21st century, statistically right up there with a Dylan Cruz, with a Rock Chulaski. Drew Burris is his own conversation that I'm excited to kind of go deeper on as we get closer to the draft, yeah. because he's a 5'9", maybe right-handed hitting outfielder, which is not a profile that essentially has ever existed as an impact player. You can say Mookie Betts, and I am having stood next to both of them. Mookie Betts, I think, has 2 inches at least on Drew Burris. So Drew Burris, I'm going to move to the side. He's going to probably still be a top 10 pick because of his pedigree. But wow, Vaughn Lackey. I was so impressed with this guy. He's someone that did not arrive on campus as a particularly top prospect the way that Drew Burris did, the way that Dylan Cruz did, the way that Rock Chulaski did. But in his 3 years at Tech, holy crap. This is a case where someone who really grew into his body and is clearly the best athlete on the field decided to play catcher, which is just not normally what happens. Normally, those guys are playing center field, they're playing shortstop. He has said he loves being a catcher, and that creates this incredible profile of a hitter who's only gotten better with serious juice, a tremendous defender behind the plate with an awesome arm, with clear plus speed, which who knows if that manifests in stolen base totals, but he is clearly a plus runner and just a joy to watch. So should Vaughn Lackey be in play at the top for the White Sox? I don't know, maybe. Yeah. At the very least, I think the Rays are probably considering him at number two. So, yeah, I'm just so impressed with him, and I think I would be shocked if he goes any lower than three.
Two things on Vaughn Lackey. It is V-A-H-N, not V-A-U-G-H-N. This is coming from
someone who
for a long time thought it was Dylan C-R-U-Z. Go ahead.
Yes. Did you see why it's Vaughn, V-A-H-N?
No.
I just found this out. This is courtesy of Rob Bradford, who rightfully went over to Boston College and interviewed Vaughn Lackey over the weekend. Vaughn said that it is because the connection is to the Autobahn. His parents, I guess, wanted him to be like B-A-H-N. And so this is what Vaughn Lackey said, okay, in this interview. And then I guess they wanted him to be fast, which he is. I don't know. Fascinating. I'm recounting what Vaughn Lackey explained.
Whoa.
And this did not sound like Vaughn Lackey was making a joke. This sounded like some Otto amount of Vaughn. Explanation that he got from his parents. So that's fascinating. Anyway,
vroom,
yes,
vroom, baby.
So
that's the first part.
But he's
and then the other
I was
thing
just so impressed with him.
I want to bring up quickly about Vaughn Lackey, mm-hmm. black catcher. Over the last handful of years, we have seen a rise in a return of black catchers at the major league level. Bo Naylor, Drake Baldwin. And I think that is a sign that our sport is getting, again, we got a long way to go, is getting better. There was like a 20-year gap there between Charles Johnson and Bruce Maxwell. of a black American or, you know, North American, Bo Naylor's case, catcher in the majors. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Institutional racism in scouting, the resources that you need to become a good catcher, the amount of gate, like there's a lot going on there that we have Von Lackey, a black catcher, going top five in the draft out of college. That is like, that's a good, that's a big thumbs up. I'm very excited about this kid. I cannot wait to watch him.
I was so impressed with him. So yeah, the Rays are picking second. The Twins are picking third. So the White Sox maybe have this tough choice at the top. But in that respect, I think the Rays and Twins are in a pretty good spot there to kind of snag whoever ends up there. So yeah, those are of course the big names that we're thinking about. I mean, there's a lot of other themes. You can go read about them at Yahoo this week. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to hit on, but I'm excited. I'm excited for the tournament. People should tune in. We got conference tournaments going on this week. I'll be at the draft combine at the end of June as well, interviewing some of these players. But yeah, this is a fun time of year starting to put these guys in order.
I'm excited. You know, I mentioned this earlier. I'm going on vacation for a little bit. I will be off for a couple podcasts. I'll just use that downtime to dig into the draft. My wife will be like, "Hey, what are you doing? You want to go for a walk?" Nope. Grinding tape. Before we get out of here, thank you to Ingrid Rosas, Andrew Hartz for producing. Thank you to you, Jordan. Before we get out of here, a thank you to the 2025-26 Buffalo Sabres, our beloved Sabres, whose season ended in absolutely soul-crushing fashion on Monday night with an overtime loss to the Montreal Canadiens in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference semifinals, the second round of the playoffs. A well-fought season. A season that changed the way I think about sports. A season that made me remember why I like this stuff in the first place, that it is about the emotion, the people. It is about often the irrationality of it. It has changed the way that I go to work every day. I feel like I'm better able to relate to fans in their irrationality, their rational irrationality. And so to the Sabres, thank you. To the Sabres community, thank you for embracing us and welcoming us. We will be back. This is not a one-year fling, both for the Sabres and for us. But for now, we say farewell and huzzah.
And to the Canadiens fans, good luck against the Canes, because you're going to need it. Thank you all for listening. We will talk to you on Friday.